It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the latest in the Senate confirmation hearings for President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees.
First, this afternoon, President Obama gave his final news conference to members of the White House press corps before he hands the reins over to his successor.
In his final meeting with the press, he answered questions about commuting Chelsea Manning's prison sentence after she leaked sensitive documents to WikiLeaks, U.S. sanctions against Russia, and fielded questions about the peaceful transition from his administration to Trump's, and a lot more.
Lily Gorin joins us now. She's a professor of politics and global studies at Carroll University. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on again today.
Well, what was your sense about this final press conference of President Obama's?
Well, you know, I think there was some symbolism to it because some of the discussion about moving the White House press corps outside of the White House itself. And I think that it was also, you know, a discussion of what's been going on, what the president's been doing in his last couple of days in office in terms of pardons. This is always where you have, you know, a number of pardons often. And just, you know, a sort of, I guess, a kind of a swan song.
And one of the top stories from this press conference today was clemency granted to Chelsea Manning. What did he say about that?
Well, he had said that Chelsea Manning had served tough time and had essentially paid for the crime that she had committed with regard to giving the documents, the security documents over to WikiLeaks, and thus didn't pardon Manning, but commuted the sentence.
And did he address the concern that the clemency would, if not encourage, at least maybe make it a little less daunting for others who wanted to, were thinking about leaking documents of some sort?
I guess that remains to be seen. And there was a discussion about whether or not this was a sort of indication of an opening for you know, for Julian Assange to be sent back to the United States or sent to the United States. I don't know. And Obama kind of dismissed that. And so he said that that wasn't a consideration in his decision.
And the president also addressed the peaceful transition of power and his conversations with President-elect Donald Trump. And here's what he had to say.
I have offered my best advice, counsel, about certain issues, both foreign and domestic, and you know, my working assumption is that having won an election opposed to a number of my initiatives and certain aspects of my vision for where the country needs to go, it is appropriate for him to go forward with his vision and his values.
Aside from that, did the president give any other sense of what the tenor was like between himself and Donald Trump, two administrations, one coming in, one outgoing, that there has been some friction between?
Yeah, I mean, Trump has tweeted about friction, and then he's rolled back those tweets. And you know, in terms of the Obama administration leaving office, they have, you know, sent over lots of briefing books and lots of information. But Trump himself has appointed very few people thus far to positions that need Senate confirmation. So, you know, you have the entire civil service that is non-presidential appointee that will just continue on. But Trump has only nominated, I think, 28 people as of today to fill close to 700 positions. And so the Obama administration has, you know, tried to do their best, as I understand it, like previous administrations, George W. Bush when he was leaving office, Bill Clinton when he was leaving office, the first President Bush when he was leaving office, in terms of providing information and briefings and accessibility to, you know, sort of, this is the job that you're going to have. But there are a lot of people who we don't know who's going to be in those jobs at this point.
Lily Gorin is with us right now. She's a professor of politics and global studies at Carroll University, talking about President Obama's final news conference as president. And Lily, the president also indicated that he may be a civilian when he leaves the White House, but in some senses, he may not be silent. On some issues, he might speak up. What did he say about that?
I mean, he said that if there are questions that he particularly thought were about equality, I think, that he would not necessarily keep his mouth completely closed. You know, previous presidents oftentimes give the next president space when they first come into office. And George W. Bush has been particularly quiet during his post-presidential period. But presidents are not always quiet, and they do, you know, continue often to work in politics or policy in lots of ways, as we've seen. Jimmy Carter has spent his post-presidency doing work with Habitat for Humanity, and George H.W. Bush has done a lot of kind of fundraising for disasters in a variety of places. Bill Clinton has the Clinton Foundation. And George W. Bush has done a lot of work on behalf of veterans. He's just done it quite quietly.
And the president was more blunt in that regard when talking about what he might do, what action he might take if the Trump administration decided to try to deport Dreamers. And here's a bit of that.
They are our kids' friends and their classmates, and are now entering into community colleges or, in some cases, serving in our military. The notion that we would just arbitrarily or because of politics punish those kids when they didn't do anything wrong themselves, I think would be something that would merit me speaking out. It doesn't mean that I would get on the ballot anywhere.
Immigration, of course, remaining a hot button and an unresolved issue. Lily, can you tell us about the Dreamers that he's talking about there?
Yeah, the Dream Act was something that's been proposed, and that through an executive order with regard to the current immigration law, that the individuals who had come here when they were young, when they were children, and thus didn't come on their own volition, but have, you know, are in the United States illegally, as it were, but have gone through school here, and are many of whom have now been serving in the military or trying to go to college, that they not be the top priority for deportation.
And finally, Lily, as we wrap up, the president indicated that there's still some things that he's worried about. I don't know if they keep him up at night, but there's their concerns. And one of these is the health of democracy.
You don't want to have an America in which a very small sliver of people are doing really well, and everybody else is fighting for scraps, as I said last week. Because that's oftentimes when racial divisions get magnified, because people think, well, the only way I'm going to get ahead is if I make sure somebody else gets less, somebody who doesn't look like me or doesn't worship in the same place I do. That's not a good recipe for our democracy. I worry about, as I said in response to a previous question, making sure that the basic machinery of our democracy works better. We are the only country in the advanced world that makes it harder to vote rather than easier.
The president, they're getting it at voting rights, getting at democracy. He touched on this in a televised address last week as well. Lily, what does it mean as we wrap up that the president is keeping the spotlight on democracy and how to keep it healthy as he leaves with his final press conference?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of discussion with regard to access to the ballot. And as the president said, it's become, in fact, slightly more difficult to vote in a lot of states. And so he talked about this actually in 2012 when he won re-election. And so I don't know that this is a new issue. And he's talked about, you know, sort of working in on this area as he moves into his private life as a citizen.
Lily, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
That was Lily Gorin, professor of politics and global studies at Carroll University. She joined us to talk about President Obama's final news conference as president.
Right now, as President-elect Trump gears up to take over from President Obama this Friday, his nominees for the cabinet are continuing their confirmation hearings in front of Senate panels.
Among those facing questions this week are Michigan billionaire and philanthropist Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education, Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to head the EPA, and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. She's being considered for ambassador to the United Nations.
Paul Singer joins us now. He's Washington correspondent for USA Today. He's been watching these hearings among all the happenings in D.C. right now. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, some of the latest news, and maybe not the most surprising news, retired General James Mattis was cleared by a Senate panel, a 26-1 vote. No surprise, no expectation that the full Senate would shoot down his nomination as defense secretary, is there?
No. We expect Mattis to clear early and to clear. Keep in mind, the Senate is likely to come back in session Friday afternoon after the inauguration and take some votes to confirm some of these people so that Mr. Trump takes office with a particular national security team in place. And I think Mattis is going to be uncontroversial. I think John Kelly at DHS will probably be uncontroversial. And these are things they feel that they need to get done and get done fast.
Before we dig deep into some specific nominations that do seem a little more controversial, we've seen some signs in the last couple of days of things that in the past had led to the rejection or withdrawal of past cabinet nominees. We see the Health and Human Services Secretary, Tom Price, from Congress, an investment he'd made in a healthcare company shortly before making a vote. Wilbur Ross at Commerce found that he'd employed an undocumented housekeeper, Office and Management and Budget nominee Mick Mulvaney, some unpaid taxes from years back, not a huge amount of unpaid taxes. But these, again, are things that once upon a time sunk nominations.
You know, times have changed. It was Zoe Baird, I think it was, wasn't it, who had the nanny problem in the first time? Part of it is that, and I mean this with no disrespect to the president-elect, but when you have a president-elect who has refused to release his taxes, who has a whole bunch of unresolved conflicts in his business enterprises, who has been caught on record talking about grabbing women by the genitals, you have to ask, what would be the standard by which a nominee would be disqualified? What would be a disqualifying statement? It's hard to find. I mean, I think you will see some of these nominees will get some grief over this stuff, which I think is probably appropriate. But at the moment, there's no real uproar to have them withdraw. Now, you know, there are some votes that might be close. You know, Rex Tillerson might get a close vote because there are Republicans who are concerned about his ties to Russia. That's sort of a bigger deal than whether or not you paid a nanny. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, the times have changed. You know, Rob, I joke that once upon a time we used to be concerned about fighting words. Remember when people used fighting words? We all got offended. Oh, that was a fighting word. Now, who knows?
Well, let's dig into some of the high-profile nominations. Betsy DeVos from Michigan, from a wealthy family connected to Amway. She has made a lot of donations based on school choice in the past years, and her group has. What are some of the concerns that Democrats have in the brief time allotted to them, pressed some pretty serious challenges to her? What have you seen?
Yeah, you know, she didn't perform especially well during her hearing. She seemed to be a little confused about, for instance, requirements for schools to provide educational opportunities for students with disabilities. It's a federal requirement. She suggested it was up to the states and then later had to clarify and say, oh, sorry, I made a mistake. I was confused. She got into a dispute with Senator Franken about the difference between progress, that is testing progress or growth, and testing sort of basic proficiency. It was not clear that she knew the difference. You know, she just didn't perform especially well in her hearing. Didn't look like she was all that well briefed. Again, so what? You know, do the Democrats have the three or four Republican votes they need to block her nomination? Probably not. So all this then is noise. But, you know, I'm a reporter. I enjoy the noise.
Let's give a listen to Senator Tim Kaine, former vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine, longish back and forth here with Betsy DeVos.
Do you think that schools that receive K-12 schools that receive government funding should meet the same accountability standards, outcome standards?
All schools that receive public funding should be accountable, yes.
Should meet the same accountability standards?
Yes, although you have different accountability standards between traditional public schools and charter schools.
But I'm really interested in this.
Okay,
should everybody be on a level playing field? So public charter or private K-12 schools, if they receive taxpayer funding, they should meet the same accountability standards.
Yes, they should be very transparent with the information, and parents should have that information first and foremost.
And if confirmed, will you insist upon that equal accountability in any K-12 school or educational program that receives federal funding, whether public charter, or private?
I support accountability.
Equal accountability for all schools that receive federal funding.
I support accountability.
Okay, change goes on there, Paul.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So people are watching this. Maybe, probably she'll be confirmed, but people are watching this for signs of what federal government education policy is going to be like in a Trump administration.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it should come as no surprise to people that in a Republican administration, you are, particularly with Betsy DeVos being the nominee for Secretary of Education, you are going to find an administration that is much more welcoming to charter schools, to private schools, to faith-based schools, to voucher programs. These are all things that Republican administrations have been pushing for years. My recollection is it was Newt Gingrich in 94 who piloted a voucher program for the D.C. schools that the D.C. schools were sort of, the D.C. voters were not particularly interested in, but Congress, of course, controls our budget. So, you know, I don't think anybody should be surprised you get to a philosophical discussion like this, which is, you know, should we have more charter schools, more private schools, or should we be investing more heavily in public schools? And the Democrats are going to say invest in public schools, and Republicans are going to say school choice.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today about the latest in national politics, focusing on confirmation hearings today. Scott Pruitt, seen as an unlikely choice in some ways to head the Environmental Protection Agency. He's, as Attorney General in his state, he's sued it repeatedly. Yeah. And he's been called a climate change skeptic in the past. He's switched gears a little bit. Here he is during his hearing today.
Do you agree that global warming is a hoax?
I do not, Senator.
So Donald Trump is wrong?
I do not believe that climate change is a hoax.
Okay, that's important for the president to hear.
That's with Democratic Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts. He still questions how much of a role humans play in climate change and how much we should do about it, but a little different stance. And this seems like something, Paul, that Democrats are trying to do a lot, find distinctions between what the cabinet nominees are saying and what Donald Trump has said on the campaign trail and since.
Right, and I think you have to remember, and again, with no disrespect intended to the president-elect, that on the campaign trail, he said a lot of stuff about a lot of subjects that was kind of all over the map. It was a little unclear to us where he stood on any given subject, and particularly if you go back 5 years, his positions on a lot of these subjects were dramatically different than they are now. So we're looking at these nominees to get a sense of which part of the spectrum of Donald Trump's views they appear to be representing, because Donald Trump's views on a lot of these issues are a spectrum. So it appears, from this conversation at least, that Mr. Pruitt does believe that global warming is an issue, does not think it's a hoax, but raises questions about whether or not significant regulatory action should be taken to limit emissions from U.S. industries. Again, that is a philosophical question that it should not be all that surprising to people. It is certainly much less surprising than the allegation that global warming is a hoax invented by the Chinese to bankrupt the U.S. economy. And I think It then gets you to this process of a much more sort of public dialogue about what are the right restrictions, what are the proper costs and benefits we should be looking for. And I think you'll find a very conservative position being advocated by Mr. Pruitt.
And then in a similar vein, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations nominee, Nikki Haley, currently governor of South Carolina, when asked about Russia, she took a little different tack than President-elect Trump.
Russia is trying to show their muscle right now. It is what they do. And I think we always have to be cautious. I don't think that we can trust them. I think that we have to make sure that we try and see what we can get from them before we give to them. They certainly have done some terrible atrocities when you look at things in Syria and how they are working with Iran. And I think that we have to continue to be very strong back and show them what this new administration is going to be. And it is going to be an America that shows exactly where we stand, what we are for, what we are against, and how we're going to proceed. And I think that we need to let them know we are not okay with what happened in Ukraine and Crimea and what is happening in Syria. But we're also going to tell them that we do need their help with ISIS and with some other threats that we all share.
With that reference to atrocities in Syria, also a little different tactic than Rex Tillerson, who was confronted on whether he would describe Russian actions as war crimes in Syria. So what did you make of Governor Haley there?
Well, again, I mean, even Tillerson took a sort of harder line view on Russia than Trump. In fact, I think I can say fairly at this point that President-elect Trump is the least concerned person in Washington about Russia. Everybody else, Republicans, Democrats, his own cabinet nominees, Mr. Mattis as defense secretary, even Tillerson, Haley now, have all said basically the same thing, which is that we can't trust Russia. We have to be very concerned about Russia. We don't know what they're up to, and they are a serious threat. The only person who's not saying that loudly is Mr. Trump, and we will see whether that is just sort of his opening negotiating position or that's where he ends up being. But everybody sitting next to him at the cabinet table is going to be saying to him, Mr. Trump, these people scare us.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
That's Paul Singer with USA Today, taking a look at the latest in Senate confirmation hearings. No matter where you live in Wisconsin, there's probably a reason you live there, something that drew you to that community. Natural beauty, stuff to do, lots of people nearby or no people nearby, access to jobs, the list goes on.
And there are probably things you think might improve your community if someone would just take the lead and make it happen.
Our next guest helps communities make those ideas a reality by embracing the idea of placemaking to bring out the unique local identity, and he and the Design Wisconsin team bring local citizens together to set the agenda.
Here are some voices from Grantsburg, Wisconsin, after a community planning meeting.
I feel like I'm actually having a part in it, and that I get to have a voice where teenagers don't always get to have a voice, so I really appreciate that.
They integrated it all, and they created these pictures of what could be. And for me, and I think for the community, it was very powerful too, because it made us be able to see the future based on what people in town thought we needed.
It happened here. People are engaged, for sure.
Todd Johnson joins us now. He's a UW Extension Land Use and Community Development Specialist based at UW River Falls. Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, what is this idea of placemaking? What does that mean?
Well, it's a term that's being kicked around all across the country right now. Academia, I would say the public sector and the private sector and nonprofits are all trying to define it for themselves. I'm part of a UW Extension research team called Community Vitality and Placemaking, and we've spent quite a bit of time researching it ourselves. And I think once we look at all the different definitions floating around, at least for me, placemaking is about making is about people making decisions and putting those ideas into action that help kind of enhance, protect, and promote the unique qualities that make up where they live.
Yeah, and it sounds like this is the opposite of sort of a one-size-fits-all approach to here's what makes a town or city or community work. It really sounds like it has to come from the bottom up.
Oh, yeah, definitely. This is definitely driven by the community. It's about community values. It's about culture and history and the landscape there. And it's about getting people involved.
And you lead people through a really unique and what, dare I say, fun sounding process. Can you talk about what you and your team do when you visit a community? You've done a few of these now in Wisconsin.
Yeah. So I got to give credit to Minnesota, the state of Minnesota. They started a process back in 1983 called the Minnesota Design Team, and they have a community charrette process that we've modeled ours off of, and we just kind of added some more bells and whistles to it and buried it within our UW Extension system. And what it really is it's a What we do is we bring a team of volunteer planners and designers and scientists into a community of about 20 folks maybe, and spend an extended weekend living with host families in that community and learning and exploring what makes that community tick, and then facilitating just a barrage of intense and fun public engagement and participation sort of activities that get people really excited about exploring what it means to be a part of community there and get a sense of what they want to have in the future. And when we leave them with hand-drawn renderings of a future that they told us they wanted to have. So these aren't pie-in-the-sky ideas. They're what the community told us that they wanted to have. And we listen really carefully and pay attention and then draw those ideas out and give them some ideas on how they might meet those goals.
And Todd, when I think of the phrase attend local planning meeting, I think better caffeinate beforehand. This sounds dull. That is not how this works, is it? This is a pretty lively session.
Oh, yeah. It's very fast-paced, and it's designed to intentionally provide the illusion that this is quick and easy and fun. There's actually quite a bit of planning that goes into it, into the logistics of bringing a group of 20 professional volunteers into your community to do this kind of work. But it's done this way so that, you know, the general community shows up to these activities. It's fun. It's engaging. They get to express their thoughts and ideas. And then they show up the very next night and, boom, there it is. A bunch of beautiful drawings of their community and the future that they told us that they wanted to have. And so it's pretty instantaneous for most of the community members. And it helps because then it's easy for them to jump into implementation.
Talking to Todd Johnson from UW Extension, talking about placemaking, ways to help communities find their own identity and come up with plans to make their communities better. And Todd, let's get into a couple concrete examples. We played some voices from Grantsburg there. You've been there in a couple other communities. What kind of ideas have emerged from this process, from these meetings?
Sure. So, we piloted the Wisconsin version of this in Grantsburg, and things that came out of that was cleaning up their waterfront in their downtown, looking at acquiring some land in the downtown to do maybe a public-private partnership that would clean up a brownfield site, maybe redevelop it as a mixed-use building, and then taking advantage of all the wonderful natural amenities and public park systems there and creating a trail system and enhancing it with signage and benches and rest areas. And then, let's see, what else? Oh, and then in Bailey's Harbor, we were there last fall, and it was providing some clear access to the waterfront. Again, there was some trail development there, making a community center out of an existing structure and just kind of activating it with more intentional uses throughout the year. Just lots of really kind of fun stuff. Not necessarily always bricks and mortar type things. Sometimes it's much more about organizational development or economic development.
And watching that video from Grantsburg, a common theme from people seemed to be, this is stuff that people have been thinking about on an individual level, or they might talk to, you know, their spouse about it and thinking, oh, somebody ought to do blank. This is bringing that together and trying to harness that ideas and get people together on what that blank is that they should do and who should do it.
Right. And the process that we use, we just try to create a really fun atmosphere that everybody feels safe expressing their ideas, and that it's democratic. So the results that come out of that, the public feels like this makes sense. It's rational. We got all of our thoughts and feelings out on paper, and we were able to decide as a community this is what's important. And then and then we just take those ideas from the written format and then just draw them out. And because they're hand-drawn, they're kind of sketchy looking, sketchy in a good way. And they have that that character, and you can recognize that this is my community. These folks came in, and they really dove into our community for the weekend, and it's pretty inspirational, the things that come out of this, and it makes it easier for community folks to grab a hold of these ideas and run with them.
So what happens next? You told me the other day that the fear of any planning process is that the end result is a binder, and the binder gets filed, and nobody looks at it ever. How do you make sure that these great ideas that came from local citizens actually start happening?
Sure. So, like I said, we kind of allude to the fact that we intentionally make this thing look simple and easy and instantaneous and fun, but there is quite a bit of planning that takes place up front, and we have our local educators, extension educators in each county that work with the community ahead of time, anywhere from 3 months on the low end, but, you know, 6 to 8 months on the long end of planning going into this. And part of that is for them to develop the capacity to implement ideas afterwards. And so our community educators will work with them on the front end to help bring our team there. And then after our team is there, they're there to help them implement those ideas and kind of coach them along. When we do these presentations on our design team visits, the very last sort of slide that we show is a sign-up sheet. What we find is that people are quick to run up to that sign-up sheet and commit themselves to implementing these ideas. And it doesn't take much more than a couple of weeks before you start seeing action teams organically develop around some of these drawings. And they really kind of just run with scissors with it. It's really fun.
Todd Johnson is with us. He's a UW Extension Land Use and Community Development Specialist based at UW River Falls. We're talking about placemaking, how local communities can figure out their identity, get citizens involved in coming up with ideas, and then making concrete improvements for the future.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 and tell us about your community. What do you love about the place you live? When people ask you what's special about your community, what do you tell them about? And what could make it even better or a lot better? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about placemaking in Wisconsin and how local communities can figure out their identity and how to improve the local quality of life. Todd Johnson is with us from UW Extension. He works with local communities to bring people together for local planning.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What is special about the place you live? What's a selling point? What keeps you there? What brought you there? And what do you dream of as a way to improve it, a problem to solve, an opportunity to make life better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our first caller now. Angie is on the line in Sheboygan. Angie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Angie?
Well, I've lived in Sheboygan for about 12 years now, and what I love about it compared to any other place I've lived is that there are so many natural spaces that are accessible to the public.
And that's something that brought you there, maybe, or at least keeps you excited about living there?
Yes, I'm very excited to live here. The lakefront is beautiful. There are forests throughout the community that you can go and hike. It's wonderful.
Angie, thanks so much. I've spent some time in Sheboygan. No argument for me. And Todd, something that strikes me as I look at things like planning and community leadership and things like that, the things that Angie is talking about, somewhere, somebody along the line actually made them happen or took steps to make these things accessible to the community, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And we're so blessed in the state to have kind of a diverse sort of range of landscapes all across the state. And I think that when you go around and talk to folks in their communities, everyone is so very proud of the natural environment and the amenities that they have in their communities. And I think a lot of the work that we end up doing in these communities is just helping them protect and enhance those attributes.
Angie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Todd, I know since this is a big project, you only do, I think, a couple of these intensive sessions a year. But for somebody out there, a community member, maybe a local business person or a local government person, if they're thinking, yeah, I want to try to do something at least a little like this, a step in that direction, what kind of starting points would you recommend for them?
Sure, and I got to give credit to our research team and to our professor emeritus, Steve Grabow, who wrote a book on this called Principles and Practice of Community Placemaking. And this is a UW Extension publication that they can get from the Learning Store or from any of their county offices. And in that, he really details wonderfully a whole suite of different activities that people can engage in to kind of, you either kind of dip your toe into that idea of what the world of placemaking is about with some, you know, some learning activities and facilitated discussions or walking tours, or, you know, you can start doing sort of a scavenger hunt of placemaking attributes within your community and kind of score how you feel your community is doing on different attributes, or moving into more of the planning stuff where you get into just the narrative sort of visioning of what you want your community to be when it grows up, or you can get into some of the mapping stuff that we do as well. We did some really fun work down in Fort Atkinson where we had a gymnasium full of community members, and we gave them maps, and we had them kind of map out all the things that they love most about their community, and then we synthesize that into a composite, and then that map they can use to make targeted investments and figure out, you know, this is kind of the bones of the city, and these are the things that make this city unique and special, and we want to make sure that we protect these things. And so, you know, those are just some types of activities that are out there, and there's many more. I mean, we're just scratching the surface of this topic ourselves, but we definitely have a publication out there if people are interested, in a website as well, of course.
Talking to Todd Johnson from UW Extension about community placemaking, finding unique things about communities in Wisconsin and enhancing them, bringing citizens on board to do something like that. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. What's the selling point for your community? What could change it? Have you worked on something to add an amenity of some sort to your city, a new park, say, or an event? Call 800-642-1234. Also call in with your questions for Todd. Liz joins us next in Madison. Liz, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Liz?
Oh, I wanted to tell you that what's so neat and cool about Madison is in the summer you can paddleboard on the lake. So we're on an isthmus and we're surrounded by water. And so you can kayak and paddleboard and windsail and do all of these fun water activities. And then in the wintertime, when it freezes over, you can ice skate and you can cross-country ski. You can go out there with your dogs. You can build a fire. You can ice fish. So many different things. And I don't know if it's great to be telling everybody that it's so amazing in Wisconsin here, or I'm originally from Chicago, and even though we have Lake Michigan, it's just less accessible to so many people who don't live that close to the lake.
Liz, thanks a lot for the call. And Todd, a lot of communities in Wisconsin, of course, are built on or near water, whether that's a river, a lake, or a great lake. And it's a struggle in a lot of places to figure out how to make the best use of that for residents, for tourism, whatever. Is this a common challenge facing communities?
Yeah, I think so. Every community has its own culture and value system, though, and that always comes into play when we look at how developed are those lakes and shorelines and the amount of public access versus it being privately developed. It really ranges all over the map. And then water quality and how individual landowners and the public treat that adjacent property and how that affects the water and the surrounding ecosystem. So it varies from community to community, but I think that in general, I think people understand the value of the water and how much it has contributed to their enjoyment of living in the places where they do live. So it's not a hard sell to talk to people about taking care of their water space.
Liz, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Todd, a lot of our concrete examples so far have related to making the most of the natural environment. But what other kinds of things do communities come up with when they go through the process? What kind of not natural resource related things do we see coming out of these meetings?
So there's the built environment. There's all the sort of infrastructure that makes up a community, the street system, the buildings, the downtown, and lighting, signage, historic buildings are definitely become a priority in a lot of communities as a physical asset. But then there's also the economic sort of assets as well, and the business community. And then probably one of the most important is just the social and community activities that occur and organizations that kind of make up this complex organism that we call communities, and how does that function? And that's, I think, probably one of the most fun things about visiting these communities and spending time with them is kind of getting to know them as a personality.
Let's bring on another caller now. Jesse is with us in Shell Lake. Jesse, hi.
Hi. Hey, I just wanted to say I live up here in Shell Lake, Wisconsin, and they, what I love about up in this area that's so much fun is all the little communities, they're all so small but so close together. So they have all the amazing little, each town has their own little festival, like Cumberland with Rutabaga Fest and Spooner with the rodeo and Shell Lake with Town and Country Days. So you have all those things going on all in a row at different times. So you can always make them, and they have just amazing food and just lots of fun things, lots of things for the communities up here to get together and do. So it's a lot of fun.
Jesse, thank you so much for sharing that. And Todd, those community events are part of the picture too.
Oh, definitely. A lot of communities are, that's their main sort of way that they're identified is by the big community or festival thing that they do each year. It's a sense of pride. It's something that brings the community together. For a lot of them, it's an economic development strategy as well. But I think that, most importantly, it's a quality of life. It's a celebration, a festive sort of thing that they create for themselves and for the people who live there. And those festivals are very important.
Time, I think, for one more caller. Becky is with us in Delavan. Becky, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'll just segue into talking about the different festivals and activities. I work in the Delavan area, which is very close to Lake Geneva, and this area is known predominantly for Lake Geneva, and I think Delavan Lake gets kind of lost in the shuffle, if you will. But they have Sky Circus on Ice, which is coming up in February. Over the summer months, we do Shake the Lake, which is a music festival. You're right on the lakefront. There's all kinds of food. There's activities going on. Of course, the lake, on Delavan Lake. Any activity that you want to do on any other lake is available, from SUP, kayak. We've got a beach. It's just a beautiful, very, very family-friendly location. And Delavan itself is very historic.
And Becky, I have to jump in because we're just about out of time, but thank you for telling us about that. And Todd, is this what it comes down to? Communities need people like Becky to be that booster and talk up the great things in their community?
That's part of it. But, it's also just the sense that people take ownership of their community and participate in the decision-making, whether it's small decisions or big decisions, and are willing to roll up their sleeves and contribute. And I think that's probably the main story, is just recognizing that we do live in a place together with other folks, and we can contribute and make this place even better.
Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Todd Johnson. He's a UW Extension Land Use and Community Development Specialist based at UW River Falls. You can find out more about placemaking at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll have some information linked there. And while you're there, you can tell us the great thing about your community, the thing that keeps you living there that you're proud of, and maybe something you'd like to see to improve it. Again, that's all at the Central Time Facebook page.
There's a never-ending conflict in just about every Wisconsin winter. On a snowy day or an icy day, should schools stay open or should they close down?
It can be a tough last-minute call. The Madison School District got some criticism yesterday for staying open on an icy morning while dozens of area districts closed up. A couple of school buses ran into problems on the roads. One parent wrote, "You care nothing of the safety of the children in your care and obviously don't have the sense. God gave a goose," on the school district's Facebook page.
But if districts are too quick to call things off, they can also get criticism on that end, too, as parents have to scramble to figure out childcare.
So it's a balancing act, and we want to hear from you. Do you think schools should err on the side of caution and close when the weather looks bad, or should they stay open as much as they possibly can?
Share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you more worried about getting kids there safely, or are you worried about losing those instructional hours? What do you think? Inconvenience or safety or a mix of the two? Let us know. At Central Time, WPR is our Twitter handle if you want to tweet us. You can also post your thoughts, maybe your stories, on the Central Time Facebook page. And our email address is talk@WPR.org.
And one thing I know for sure on a sometimes fuzzy debate, I'm glad I'm not the one making that call.
That's probably always true. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.